Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby from Bennington, Vermont. 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, we'll explore the urban environment. First, we'll look at the threat of drug-resistant infectious diseases, which often thrive in cities. While we once believed humans would be free of disease, many scientists now say that we set our sights too high. We'll contemplate the idea of the sustainable city and look at the way we currently develop most of our land. And then we'll meet a woman in New York who has taught people in her community to compost their kitchen scraps. And author and children's advocate Jeffrey Canada will have a portrait of a place in New York City. These stories and more coming up this week on The Environment Show. In 1969, then Surgeon General of the United States William Stewart told Congress it was time to close the book on infectious disease. Many doctors like Stewart believed that we were well on our way towards winning the war against bacteria and viruses. But few people are that optimistic today. Environmental degradation, coupled with what many call the overuse of antibiotics, has left us with a legacy of drug-resistant bacteria. Some say another plague could be in the cards. Thomas Lally takes a look at just how threatened we are.
Right now, there are trillions of microorganisms all over you and billions more inside your body. But don't be alarmed. Many of them help you. That's because, as a species, humans have evolved along with these microorganisms. For instance, some of them help us digest our food, and in return, they live comfortably in our intestines. But out of all these tiny creatures, there are some we don't get along with so well. These are the bacteria and viruses that make us sick. When that happens, our immune system fights them off. And when that fails, we've developed drugs to combat these microorganisms. But today, these drugs are much less effective, and diseases like tuberculosis, which was once considered nearly eliminated, is coming back with a vengeance. Gretchen Daly is a researcher at Stanford University. She's released a report, along with Paul Ehrlich, saying we should give up trying to win the war against infectious diseases and learn to live with them.
You can't completely get rid of diseases. All you can do is continue to wage the battle in a way that gives you the upper hand, and that's the best that we can aim for, and that's the sensible thing to aim for. We were really misled early on in believing that we could actually completely eradicate these things, and it's going to be hard for us to even defend in a minor way against them.
Daly's gloomy forecast is shared by an increasing number of researchers, and the facts back them up. Today, 27,000 Americans have active cases of tuberculosis, and AIDS is the most deadly disease for 22 to 45-year-old males in most developed nations. Meanwhile, the global population continues to grow at an unparalleled rate, and today, most people live in cities, the perfect breeding grounds for disease, according to Mark LaPay, author of Breakout, The Evolving Threat of Drug-Resistant Disease. He believes the rise in infectious disease points to a profound failure of our modern way of living.
We are in constant equilibrium, dynamic equilibrium, with organisms in the environment. When we disrupt that environment through decimation of forests or through encroachments onto old, stable ecosystems, we're going to put ourselves in harm's way through the incursion of new diseases.
LaPay's approach is from a co-evolutionary perspective. He reminds us that all life, from human beings to bacteria, is constantly evolving. So while we evolve, so do diseases. In other words, humans may have won some battles, for instance our triumphs over polio and smallpox, but the war is far from over. In fact, as long as humans are around, the war will never end. LaPay sees indications that our relative vacation from disease is coming to an end, and for him, the blame falls on the destruction of the natural environment.
This book is a clarion call. It's a wake-up call to society to start thinking about the integration of the human ecosystem with that of nature more generally, and that we are constantly putting populations at peril as we exploit and disrupt ecosystems. Nature bats last.
But the situation may not be all bad. Many epidemiologists today acknowledge the link between environmental degradation and disease. To Rodney Dietert, senior fellow at the Center for Environment at Cornell University, the question is not, will we win or lose the race against disease, but how far do we want to fall behind?
I'm actually quite an optimist, but I'd say a cautionary optimist. I think that we have on hand the opportunity to make decisions that will enable us to win this race, or at least to stay even, shall we say, for a long time in the future.
Dietert believes we should continue to develop new drugs for treatment, but agrees with Lappe and Daly that fundamental changes need to be made in our approach to medicine and how we manage the environment.
We do need to wake up and start to make some very astute decisions relative to both to management in terms of how aggressively we're enabling these to be brought forward through selection, and also in terms of our capacity to bring forward the next generation of therapeutics that are going to be required.
Dietert and others recommend curtailing our use of antibiotics. Today, over half of these drugs go to livestock. Researchers say we must also seriously address population growth and engage in more sustainable development. Medical treatment must also become more proactive, attacking diseases before rather than after they strike. Researchers say we will always be living with disease. The question is, how much worse will diseases like AIDS and tuberculosis get? And what new diseases will emerge as our population grows and our environment is further altered? For The Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
When we talk about the environment, a lot of people think about eagles and bears and wild places, but the fact is that the environment that we are most familiar with is what's around us, where we live, and for most of us, that is cities and suburbs. In short, the city is environment too. Kent Barwick, president of the New York State Historical Association, tells us why cities have always been an essential part of the human experience.
The city is a stage for man. So most of the things that we do, whether it's making a business deal or looking for an apartment or meeting a girlfriend in a singles bar, are things that require cities. And for all the pronouncements about how they're going to disappear soon, they seem to be as essential and as satisfying as ever.
But for the last 40 years, most new development in America has been suburban. A situation James Kunstler, author of the book The Geography of Nowhere, thinks is obscene and must be reversed.
The future in this country, at least in the next 20 years, is going to require us to recondense the life of our nation into coherent neighborhoods and coherent cities and livable cities, because we're not going to be able to afford to continue to live in this sprawled-out arrangement we currently have.
Kunstler is adamant that we should build inside our cities by filling in the empty spaces. He abhors our compulsion to subdivide ever outward. Randolph Croxon is an architect and founding principal of the Croxon Collaborative. He argues that the American suburb is the most inefficient form of development that one could conceive of.
There is no way that you could possibly have fewer people consuming and occupying more land, creating more impervious surface, creating more linear feet of sewer and water and pipe and infrastructure stretched out over longer distances.
Fundamental to the concept of the American suburb is the automobile. Kunstler says cheap gas and cheap land has been the driving force behind suburban development. But he warns that trend is coming to an end.
The consequences of building a whole nation of automobile suburbs has been tremendously destructive to our social and spiritual life, as well as our economic life. We simply can't afford this living arrangement.
Other analysts, while sympathetic to the principles Kunstler espouses, think we have the resources to keep on sprawling. Professor of Geography Ray Bromley at the State University of New York notes that it is cheaper to keep sprawling than to clean up decayed urban sites. He adds there are underlying issues of race and social status that are as important as land use if we are to create the sustainable city.
I would really like to see a much more compact form of development. However, I would question many of the assertions which Jim Kunstler makes in his book and in numerous public presentations. First, the assertion that America can't afford sprawl. Regrettably, I don't think that that is our most important fiscal problem at this moment. And also, secondly, that there will be an energy crisis which will force us to abandon the suburbs within a very few years. I think the more important point, though, is that infilling really represents a back-to-the-cities movement, and a back-to-the-cities movement requires that America overcome its enormous problems of race and social tensions associated with race. And I would like to see us dealing with that precisely because I'd like to overcome those problems.
On future shows, we'll continue our look at cities, how they work, how they define the environment, and affect the lives of people that live within them. The Environment Show welcomes your comments. Particularly, we want to know what you believe makes a city sustainable. You can write us at P.O. Box 66600, Albany, New York 12206-6600. Or you can reach us by email at envshow@aol.com. I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, Locking Horns will feature a debate over cars and dirty air, one of the fundamental environmental problems facing cities. Some say we should mandate the sale of non-polluting cars, but the auto manufacturers say that's not realistic. Author and children's advocate Jeffrey Canada will present a portrait of a place in New York City. And we'll see how folks on the other side of New York are composting their kitchen scraps and making money at it. And our Earth calendar will feature witch hazel. This shrub is blooming now and has nothing to do with witches. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. And now it's time for Locking Horns, an Environment Show debate. All discussion about the environment and cities leads to the automobile and its effect on the air. Everyone is familiar with the smog in Los Angeles, but today air pollution affects practically every urban area. Debate over how to clean up the air rages. All states are now in the process of figuring out how to comply with stringent federal air pollution standards of the Clean Air Act. New York, Massachusetts, and California have decided to mandate sales of electric cars or other vehicles that have no emissions at all, the so-called zero-emission vehicle. But some feel this is not the right approach. Joining us are Reg Modlin, Manager of Environmental and Energy Planning for the Chrysler Corporation, and Sheila Lynch, Executive Director of the Northeast Alternative Vehicle Coalition. Locking horns over the question, should the 1998 zero-emission vehicle mandates be continued?
Mandates of any kind don't make sense. I think most people agree that mandates are not consistent with a consumer-driven free market economy. I accept that the threat of mandated production jump-started our most recent search for electric cars, but remember that electric cars have been around for the past 100 years. At one point, they even enjoyed over 20% market share. The problem was then and is now the lack of a battery that can provide sufficient range at a cost that will bring in customers. A mandate is no longer necessary because manufacturers on three continents are racing to be the first to produce a commercially acceptable electric car. If electric cars have a place in our future, none of the manufacturers want to come in second. It's our business. A commercially viable electric car will be found when three things happen. First, the technology must be available. Next, the price of the technology must be drastically reduced. And finally, customers must want the product enough to buy it once and then to buy it again. Mandates will not make these things happen. Hard work by scientists and manufacturers from around the world will.
Ms. Lynch.
The mandate should absolutely be continued. In 1989, there was one major auto company with one EV prototype, the General Motors Impact. In 1995, after the California, Mass, and New York mandates with the low-emission vehicle program, all seven of the major manufacturers and many smaller ones have advanced EV prototypes, manufacturing plans, and new partnerships have been formed with battery companies such as GM Ovonics, electronic component partnerships like the Chrysler-Westinghouse partnership, and composite vehicle partnerships such as Ford GE Plastics. Since 1990, there's been a tenfold increase in the number of patents spurred on by the technology forcing ZEV mandate. There's also been amazing technical progress on EVs. The opposition by the auto companies is the same old, same old. They have fought airbag mandates, catalytic converter mandates, and bumper mandates in court, while later societal interests won out and they went forward with the technology. The mandates need to stay in place long enough to bring the vehicles to the marketplace, which should be soon.
Mr. Modlin, in reply.
The airbag example is right on point with what I was talking about. The airbag came into existence as a result of three things happening. First, the technology finally came into play after 20 years of research. The cost came down so that we could afford to put in the cars, and consumers finally demanded the product. We're trying to do the same thing with electric vehicles, but first thing, the technology is not yet available.
Ms. Lynch, the last word.
The airbag mandate is something that is mandated, and that's what spurred on exactly the technology forcing that happened with the three auto manufacturers. It created the market, it created the technology, and it spurred the companies on. They fought it in court exactly like they're fighting EV mandates, and EVs will eventually win out like airbags.
Thank you both. The environment of cities is defined by many things, but it is people who give life and character to urban spaces. Jeff Canada, president of the Reedland Centers of Children and Families, presents a portrait of a block on West 108th Street in New York, where the buildings, people, and their memories talk to him. And finally, with our ear to the ground, we meet a lady who is literally making new ground in the densest urban environment in America.
A city block in New York is like no other place. You have to live there for years before you really understand that these are not just streets with buildings, but these are stories with heart and soul. This block, 108th Street, tells one story to those who come to visit, and another for those who have stayed a while, for those who look, for those who listen. Broadway acts like a line of demarcation. West is all luxury co-ops and condos. The affluent on the Upper West Side see a different block, hear a different story. Walk just east 20 yards, and 108th Street has another story to tell. The block is beautiful. An old Roman Catholic church sits squarely in the middle of the block. The white stone statue of the Virgin Mary perched atop the steps leading to the church gives an aura of serenity and peace. If you look up, you can see lovely stonework, adjoining arches, detailed window ledges, beautiful brick. I have walked up this block for 13 years. It is the way I walk to my karate class. I know there are many stories this block could tell, so many sad tales. Sometimes when I'm walking in the early morning sunlight, I hear the stories, the secrets of 108th Street whispered to me. The whispers are carried by the wind as it blows from east to west. You probably wouldn't hear it, but you haven't walked this block for 13 years. Do you remember little Ronald? How fast he could run, how nimbly he dodged between the parked cars. He was always running, running to catch a football, running to catch a baseball, running just to be running. He never saw the car. Running can be a problem on 108th Street. And what about Hector? Always laughing and joking, always out too late. Whatever happened to Hector? Some say he's in jail. Some say he moved. I know it was AIDS. Another secret whispered only to me on 108th Street. And Ralph. They shot Ralph right across the street from the church. Another story of senseless death on this block. In the autumn, when the wind blows the leaves on the trees, you can hear Ralph's laugh. Well, I can hear it. You probably need to walk this block for a few more years. But Victor and Rachel, they're in college now. I still hear their once secret dreams of getting off the block, making something of their lives. And there are other little ones who play on a block now, and they laugh, and I watch them play handball and tag and jump rope. They are black and brown and white, children having fun on a city block, a block like no other, and one, unfortunately, like too many others. They can't hear the soft whispers on 108th Street. I can. Sometimes those whispers make me laugh. Sometimes they make me cry.
I'm Linda Anderson, and this is Ear to the Ground, with stories about people affecting change in the environment. This week, composting in Manhattan. New York City is not the kind of place one would typically think of as home to someone who has strong feelings about doing good for the earth. But for Christine Datz Romero, who moved there in 1980 from Frankfurt, Germany, this is not a contradiction.
I think environmental work can be done any place, and especially here in the city, it's an important place to do it. And I think that it's really a misconception to think that people that live in a city are not do not care about their environment.
Initially, when she arrived in Manhattan, Datz Romero became involved with recycling and eventually began a community recycling center. But when the city started curbside collection of recyclables, it made no sense to duplicate a program that was being done efficiently. So she and her husband, Clyde, began a new venture, composting. They leased 4 city-owned vacant lots covering an area about 50,000 square feet, and created the Lower East Side Ecology Center.
People have made, have started making the commitment of saving their kitchen scraps to bring them to us. And what we have started last year in 1994 is going to the green market at Union Square, which is a local farmer's market, and we collect kitchen scraps there from people.
The kitchen scraps are then brought to the center, and in layer cake style are alternated with sawdust. Datz Romero says this is done to provide a source of carbon to the nitrogen-rich scraps. This is necessary to create an environment conducive to microorganisms, which play a part with heating up and breaking down the organic material. On a daily basis, the piles are aerated to introduce oxygen. After about 3 weeks, the piles cool down and earthworms take over. To help fund the center, the resulting fertile soil is sold as a product called dirt cheap, and worms and worm boxes are sold for easy at-home composting. Aside from Datz Romero, her husband, and 2 high school students, the East Side Ecology Center is run with the aid of volunteers. Datz Romero feels strongly about this being a community-run operation because, she says, programs like theirs really empowers a community. She believes that it's the small, innovative programs that can help solve waste problems while doing something positive for the city. With Ear to the Ground, this is Linda Anderson.
And now it's time for our Earth Calendar. This week we look at the witch hazel, a shrub which flowers now when other plants are losing their leaves. We know the witch hazel from its distinctive smell. Men might remember it from the days when barbers slashed it on the back of their necks. Barbers used witch hazel for the same reason Native Americans did. It's an astringent, which stops nicks and cuts from bleeding. Early American settlers also believed that witch hazel had other properties. Bruce Riggs is the manager of interpretation and records at the New York Botanical Gardens.
The reason why it's called witch hazel is because originally when the Europeans came to the United States, they looked for divining rods to be able to find water, which are sort of Y-shaped pieces of wood. And they would use the witch hazels that they would find, and they would take these branches that resemble the hazel tree from Europe and cut them and shape them into this divining rod and walk around and find water. And so that's how it got its name.
In this Halloween season, not all witches fly broomsticks. The witch of witch hazel means pliant branches in Old English. And English settlers named the shrub a hazel because it reminded them of hazel trees back home. We know you'll find this information useful in case you meet a witch named Hazel. And don't forget to ask her if she can find water. Thanks for joining us this week on The Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 305. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Chartog is the executive producer. The Environment Show is made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby. 1-800-CARHERE. So long. We'll see you next week on The Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, we'll take a look at issues facing the urban environment. First, we'll examine the growing threat of infectious diseases, which often thrive in cities. We'll look at the concept of the sustainable city and our current practice of suburban development. And Jeffrey Canada will present a picture of a place in New York City. So join us for these stories and much more coming up on this week's Environment Show.